Hi, I'm Kevin Flynn, and welcome to The Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about Episode 8 of the team's latest series on The State versus Jason Carroll, which deals with the 1988 murder of Sharon Johnson of Bow, New Hampshire. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, this conversation may not make a whole lot of sense. Don't get spoiled, all right? Don't spoil yourself. Go back and listen to that episode before listening on. Today's guests are Sarah Kalin, a police officer and sex crimes detective for 10 years before going into academic research in the area of criminal psychology with a concentration on serial sexual predators and serial homicide. She works now as a civilian consultant for police agencies as well as nonprofits and private entities investigating cold case homicides and rapes, particularly those with serial features. She also specializes in cases involving domestic violence. Sarah hosts a series of speaking engagements around the country, and you can hear her driving around New Hampshire in the last few minutes of our regular podcast. Sarah, thank you so much for coming back to the addendum.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
And of course, as always, we're joined by Rabia Chaudhry, the lead investigator and one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast. Hello, Rabia.
Hey, Kevin.
I imagine everybody has gotten all the tryptophan out of their system from Thanksgiving.
I actually have not. Yes. I just don't want to get out of bed lately. But I think it's the cold. I just want to hibernate or something.
Yeah. Yeah. We're getting to that end of year. And I think also the end of our season here. And it just continues to get stronger. If I do say so myself, Rabia, you're doing a great job, particularly
Thanks
with
so
this
much.
Season. In this past episode, we hear about how the investigation continued after Ken, Jason, and Tony were arrested. This was a big case, a lot of media coverage. It seemed like the news triggered people to come forward with some information, but it didn't seem like any of it was helpful. Robbie, what do you think of that? Am I right?
Yeah, well, I want to ask you, were you living there at the time? You were not there, right?
I was a college student.
Okay. So do you remember any of the coverage? It just seems like it was a huge story. It was a big deal.
What if I told you I was part of the coverage?
Were you really? Did you tell me that?
Yeah, when I was an intern, my senior year in college, I was an intern at the local radio station. And I do remember going to one of the three trials for closing arguments. And
no
I believe
way.
It was the Jason Carroll trial. And I just, the only thing I remember, this was at Hillsborough County North. It was courtroom three, which is the second one on the left-hand side. It's a big courtroom, really high ceilings. The audio is hard to get recorded inside that room, so you had to wait for the interviews during the court break. And I just remember the prosecutor, or one of the prosecutors who was giving the closing argument, start by saying, "I can't believe what I just heard the defense say." And, now I can. So, as far as the coverage, this was a big story, front page of the Union Leader, which is the statewide newspaper, also located in Manchester. And as you point out in this episode, it sort of has all of the horrible details, all of the horrible elements that make for a quote-unquote good story, where you have the victim as a sympathetic pregnant woman. You now have the story of three evil guys that conspired to kill her and, you know, for money. And that's just catnip to reporters and editors. Too bad none of it, or little of it, was true.
Well, you know, I mean, I feel like this must be an occupational hazard. Sarah, you must have experience with this, because I'm thinking anytime like something like this breaks, the police have to deal with just all kinds of wackos coming out of the woodwork saying, "I got something to share," right?
Oh, 100%. That's just par for the course on a big case. And a lot of it is people, they are at least telling themselves that they want to be helpful and they think this information is valuable. So they're really, most of them tend to be very passionate about what they're telling you. Like, "I definitely saw that guy. It was definitely," you know, and then of course it doesn't check out. But the fact remains that, you know, maybe not as much in this case, but in other cases I've worked, there are times when that weird little tidbit that comes in actually ends up blowing something wide open. And so it is important. It's tedious work, but it's important to comb through all of those and try and run them down as much as you can.
Yeah, I mean, something like somebody spotting a pregnant woman having an argument with a guy with a beard in and of itself may not feel like it connects to a homicide case, but somebody puts it together. And anything in the end, we can argue, you know, whether or not the guy with the beard, whether this is a red herring or not. But it ended up being an important part of the police's thinking of what went down. It's hard to tell unless you run it down, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to run it down. I just ran down a tip from 1993 a couple of months ago on a cold case. And the tip that came in was essentially, here's this really weird guy I went on a couple of dates with, and he couldn't stop talking about various stabbing cases. And I was, I was working on a stabbing case or whatever. And, you know, apparently on these dates, he hadn't discussed this particular one, but it was right around the same time. And the detectives at the time did not run that down, but I felt it mattered. We ran it down. Because we have a good suspect in that case, but it's important to exclude all the other possibilities, or else we're just doing the same thing that was done here, where it's like, oh, we formulate an idea and try and, you know, make the pieces fit.
Yeah, nothing sexier than going on a date and talking about stabbings.
Dude, right? Yeah. He was definitely weird. We sat in his living room for a couple of hours. He was definitely an odd duck, but
I don't know. True crime fans, they might find that really, really appealing. So one entity that I never really thought about playing a role in any kind of homicide are the funeral homes, because, I mean, they know the cause, or I should say the manner of death. And so that it's, a little different than grandma passed away. So the idea that some of the funeral home workers would have their antenna up, it was really fascinating. Rabia, talk to us about how we got to the exhumation and sort of this tete-a-tete that Ken apparently had with his dead wife in the funeral home.
This was like almost like something out of a movie, a very cinematic kind of incident that took place. And it makes me think, yeah, you don't normally think of this, but why not? I mean, like, I feel like funeral home employees and people who are up close and, personal to the deceased, they might see things the rest of us don't. And there might be times when they're like, well, they said it's a natural death, but nothing about this looks natural to me. That could make an interesting series. So, yeah, after the arrest happened, of course, and I think that's important that after the arrest, suddenly people are going to look back and think about these people they know and think, was any interaction I had with them suspicious, right? Like that's mm-hmm. how they start thinking about stuff. And so the owner of the funeral home calls the police and says, I have an employee who has something to say, and they don't explain why she didn't come forward before. Maybe because she didn't think Ken was a suspect, whatever. But according to her, the night before Sharon was actually buried, so it would be like, they've had two or three days in which they've had a memorial service, wake, this and that. The family gets to have time with the deceased before the coffin is finally sealed for burial the following day, that she was wandering around somewhere and Ken was alone with the casket, and she clearly remembered him slipping this envelope into the casket. And every evening, it's her job to tidy up the bodies, basically make sure that the clothing's okay, their hands are in the right position, nothing's been moved by people around them. And as she did so, she found the envelope, and the envelope was a bright white envelope, and it said, to Sharon from Ken, or something to that effect. And she had a very clear recollection. And she said, he put it in a place where he thought nobody could have seen it, and also at a time when he thought nobody was watching, so she found it suspicious. Now Lammy's made his arrest, but like I said, I think he knows that confessions, he also knows he has a history of confessions not always going his way. And so he's going to lock this down still. So maybe he's thinking, maybe Ken put in a letter in which he said, I'm sorry I did this, some kind of his own confession. Because remember, Ken has never opened his mouth. He's not confessed to a single thing. So they get their warrant and they literally exhume Sharon's body to find this letter. And it turns out there is a letter, but it's not anything as the funeral home employee described it. It was in fact a letter that Kathy Hampson, her close friend, Sharon's close friend, had read the day of the funeral, and then herself put in the casket, and which was a fact that the police already knew. There's only two possibilities in terms of the story. Number one, the woman completely imagined this event taking place. She completely imagined seeing Ken take an envelope and surreptitiously put it in the coffin, or he did and then he removed it, right? Mm-hmm. Before she was actually buried, which is another possibility, but that seems, I mean, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the dream would be that there's a full confession that he sealed in an envelope, you know, saying he's sorry, whatever the hell. And I can't imagine you go to the trouble of doing that and then pulling it out later. It was a tantalizing lead, but there was something that did come of it, which is that in order to exhume the body, they needed a warrant. And these warrants always kind of spell out the thinking of investigators and the justifications they believe for X, Y, and Z. So this warrant, you point out, had, you know, was particularly important because now you're getting a new sense of what the investigators are actually thinking, right?
Yeah, I think one of the weird things to me about this, about Lammy's theory and the fact that it got Jason to confess to basically the same theory, was the idea that Sharon was killed because she walked in on Ken raping his daughter. Within a matter of a week, that theory has disappeared. And I'm curious about Sarah's take on that. That seems, I mean, like, I started thinking maybe he thought, he's trying to get Jason on his side. I mean, like, he's trying to convince Jason, we can't get this horribly, horribly terrible person, Ken, without you. Like, you're our missing link. And maybe he thought this is a sympathetic story to get him to do it. I don't know. Sarah, what do you think? Do you think Lammy actually believed it at the time, and then he suddenly, a week later, is like, nah, it wasn't about that at all, and I knew it all along? I just don't know how that changed so dramatically.
Yeah, it seems to be, at least from all outward appearances, that he did genuinely believe it, that it wasn't a, you know, completely a work of fiction just to coerce Jason, right? I mean, I guess that's always possible because there's certainly, I mean, the Supreme Court has said that it's not illegal to lie to suspects, you know, in an interview or interrogation. And so you can see where he might have tried to play him to get him, you know, like you said, a sympathetic story to get him more willing to help catch this guy. But he seems to run that avenue down outside of talking to Tony. He seems to run that avenue down, you know, at least for a little while. Now, on its face, it's completely ridiculous. If you're going to kill somebody because they caught you in a sex act with your daughter, why are you going to wait a week? If she was going to tell someone, she would have told someone. I mean, the whole thing's just stupid on every level. Mm-hmm. But, it does also seem like the theory of the case was always fluid for him. It was really always just like, well, this is what I think. And like we said, you know, just trying to make the pieces fit. And when you're, theory of the end of the, you know, the answer of the case is solid, not good necessarily, but I mean like solid in your mind, and you have to make it fit, then the theory of how you got to that point is going to be fluid. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you're
yeah.
going to keep changing your mind on like, aha, this is why this makes sense in order to arrive at the conclusion that I arrived at already. And it's hard to avoid noticing that it does seem like you just arrived at a conclusion and worked backwards from there.
In any case like this, there are usually multiple warrants filed for different things, search warrants, arrest warrants, whatever. Robbie, do you recall if previous to this, at any time they made that assertion in a warrant that, you know, on this date, you know, we were told that so-and-so was raping. Did that ever come up in a legal document?
You know, I'm trying to think, and I don't remember Lammy filing any warrants prior to this, to be honest. I could be completely
really?
Blanking out. Yeah, because the warrants that were filed, there was, for example, an affidavit filed in support of a warrant when they seized Ken's car, right? There was one, well, I mean, I don't think they needed an affidavit when they went to Jason's house to get the knife, but there were some affidavits, there were warrants filed to get phone records. There were affidavits and warrants filed to get Sharon's medical records. However, all that happened well before Lammy came into the scene.
Yeah.
When Lammy came to the scene, mostly how he worked was just talking people to death, it seemed like. Versus digging up, like, he, because all of that other stuff had already existed, all the other evidence. And I can't think of another time in that entire year that he filed a warrant for anything.
I think it's blanking. A good catch on your part to see that that was not included in what they are attesting to. That's missing as far as when they're at going to a judge trying to explain the probable cause needed for anything.
Let me ask Sarah this. Would a motive normally be included? That's another thing. I don't know if in an affidavit.
Right. Okay. So for an exhumation, a judge is going to really want definite, like, hard answers of why we need to do this. Like, everything about it, everybody sort of recoils at the idea. Even I, when, you know, listening to it, when you said, you know, and then they exhumed her, I even have sort of a flinchy thing, response to that. And I'm not, you know, religious and about burial or anything. There's just something about it that feels unkind.
Invasive.
Right.
Really
to,
invasive.
To find a letter, not to do an autopsy, other evidence, right?
Exactly. Evidence. And so they would have had to have articulated, I mean, like, the warrant to the judge would have to be even more thorough than a typical one. Like, explain to me your reasoning. But it might not have to go into that fine of a detail. Do you know what I mean? If they can articulate in the warrant that they think there may be something of evidentiary value or a confession of sorts in this letter, then, you know, that's all they really kind of need to get the judge to believe in order to get the warrant. They don't have to say, we expect that the confession is going to say, I'm so sorry, I cheated on you with my teenage daughter, in order to get that warrant. They just need to convince him that maybe Ken wrote something down of value. I don't think they're wrong there. I think it's entirely possible that he did write something down of value, because he's not sociopathic. He doesn't read as sociopathic or psychopathic, where there's no remorse for what he's done. He clearly knows what he's done is wrong. He's clearly trying to get out of it. And so it's entirely possible that there was a measure of guilt, or the letter might have been to the unborn child too. It might not have been to Sharon at all.
That's true.
You know? And so, yeah, there's all kinds of real value in getting a letter if he placed one that he wrote in there. But I don't know how much detail they'd have had to have gone into with the judge. It just depends on the judge.
Yeah. One last thought on the affidavit. For those who haven't seen one, usually the format is these enumerated paragraphs stating out certain facts. Usually the first one is, my name is John Smith and I am a member of the such and such department, and I, you know, certified and blah, blah, blah. And it keeps moving down. And today, where everything is computerized, when you go for multiple warrants, you usually kind of can cut and paste or start at a new place. I've seen warrants, okay, now there's 20 paragraphs, and they go in the next thing, and they've added the 21st, right? So now Lammy's probably typing these out by hand, old school, because this is probably through computers. I would say if that had been used and then disappeared, you know, it seemed like it would definitely have been intentional that it would have been taken out, because it's just so easy to copy and paste. And, you know, judges have already, you know, been okay with all this other stuff. So it's interesting, but it's like a lot of these things where it doesn't really move the needle. Something like finding a bloody shirt, which again would have been fantastic evidence if it had turned out. Tell us, Robbie, a little more about how it was recovered.
Well, this shirt, I mean, it was another nothing burger like the exhumation. You know, they got a call from North Carolina from this guy who called himself the Wizard. He's a parapsychologist. desperately wanted to be involved, to the extent that he wouldn't give up the shirt. He was like, no, not until and unless you, like, make me part of this investigation, I'm not giving you the shirt. He had gotten the shirt from this woman who dated Tony briefly, who had forgotten about the shirt. The funny thing is, and I didn't include this in the episode because, I mean, there's so much you cannot include in these episodes, right? I mean, like, there's so many details in all these reports, but they're all kind of interesting, is that the officer who called New Hampshire, the Bedford police, I think, to say, hey, I got the shirt, or this person has the shirt, said, actually knew Tony Puff enough that when he saw the shirt, when the officer was finally shown the shirt, he actually remembered Tony wearing this California Raisins shirt at some point. And I'm guessing he knew Tony because, you know, Tony get in trouble or he's running with the wrong people. But somehow he had a recollection of once seeing Tony wearing that shirt. Now, the idea, first of all, this is a California Raisins t-shirt. It's blue. There's nothing about it that matches the description of Sharon's shirt. And it's got holes in it, you know, which they're like, maybe they're stab wounds, right? Which also is kind of weird because on one hand, they know that Sharon's bra was not stabbed through. So how her t-shirt could have, like, that her bra had been already been removed, like, or open in the front before she was stabbed. So how the t-shirt could have been stabbed through, but the bra not, you know, I mean, I don't know. But they were desperate for this shirt. This would have been an important piece of evidence. They have nothing physical to tie Tony to this crime at all. They have nothing.
They wouldn't have had anything physical to tie them to the crime with that shirt, given what, you know, where technology was at that time anyway. And also, who keeps a shirt from a murder in New Hampshire all the way down to North Carolina? He's not going to throw it in a McDonald's trash can somewhere along the way. Yeah, no, it's so stupid.
This entire idea, I mean, the whole idea, because her shirt is missing, they have to fill this hole. And the idea they come up with is that Tony took the shirt. I mean, why? Unless he was a serial killer who took mementos, right, from people, which I have never heard of any other circumstance in which, like, that kind of thing would happen, right, Sarah?
No, of course not. I mean, you want to get rid of everything that ties you to the case. You're certainly not going to carry it around for weeks. You're not going to put it in a bag to give to Jason, to give to your landlady. Who knows if she's going to open the bag and be like, yo, WTF, there's a stabby, bloody shirt in your bag. Get out of my house. You know, I mean, like, there's a million reasons why even the stupidest of criminals outside of, you know, of genuine capital S, capital K serial killers would not keep something like that.
Yeah. One thing about the California Raisins that I'd like to add that you didn't think was going to be here was, as you may recall, it was the raisin commercial that got it popular. They put together a whole album of California Raisin stuff. The drummer on that album, whose name was David Stefanelli, and Dave was in my wedding band playing
you
the drums.
Kidding me.
The band was called Mama Kicks, and he let me play the drums for a break of Back in the USSR and Down on the Corner. Again, another bunch of stuff.
Such a weird random fact. Between you and Laura Bricker, man, you guys, like, there's nothing you have. You're like the what's the name of that guy?
Forrest Gump.
Thank you, the Forrest Gump of podcasting.
Well, if next season is in North Carolina, I will not be able to help you at all. Right. Let's get back to actual questions here. Debbie Dutra put a big hole in Jason's confession and essentially was an alibi for him for the weekend following the murder. But why was that weekend significant from the perspective of the prosecution?
That was the weekend. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot, and I'm not quite sure what the answer to this is. That is the weekend that the prosecution, Jason confessed that Saturday morning, early in the morning, 10 a.m., him and Tony went to Ken's house to collect their money. Tony came out with an envelope full of $10,000 and gave him five and took five. And you know, this was part of the confession in which Jason was like, yeah, I don't remember where the house was, what it looked like, whether it had a driveway. Like, there's nothing he can remember at all about this house, but that's the only detail he gives. Now, this is also the morning, by the way, and you know, we laid this out, I think, in the first couple episodes, where the police decided to survey Ken for half a day, you know, which is kind of weird and random, but they're there, like, 11 a.m. They begin their surveillance around 11 a.m., and I think are there until late afternoon. They detail, the surveillance team details who comes and goes, and, you know, Jason's not in it, and Tony's not in it. So if they were to have gone, would have been earlier. The problem is Debbie's like, that couldn't have happened. Because Jason and his girlfriend, Leslie, which was one of her best friends, and her boyfriend, they all went to Weir's Beach that morning. And she recalled very clearly that it was around 8 a.m. the morning that they left. And they were already there before lunchtime. You know, she testified, her boyfriend, Kent Gosselin, also testified. But he didn't remember the time because it had been like 4 years, you know, by the time they got to trial, you know, and her journal backed it up, you know.
I'm trying to come up with a crazy fact about Weir's Beach to just blow you away.
Anything.
Well, it has a great arcade called Fun Spot, and I think it's the largest indoor. Sarah's like going like this. Yes, right.
The amount of time I spent junior and senior year of high school, like in the summer, at Fun Spot playing Tetris and only Tetris, like to the point of being in physical pain when I left, and like every road sign looked like a Tetris piece. It was
yes.
It was, oh my god.
Yeah.
If you still want to play Pole Position, it's the place to go.
It's still
prepare to qualify. Yes. Oh yeah. It's everything. They have a huge pinball set up. It's one of the largest, if not the largest, arcade still available in the country. Okay, well, if I don't have something goofy to throw in, then I really don't have anything to contribute. In the meantime, Tony is writing these letters saying that he's innocent, and I think, well, he was sending it to one of the Johnson kids, right?
Lisa.
Oh, well, the mom of his baby, right? His baby mom.
Yeah.
He brings up the possibility that he didn't actually move the car. What is he talking about? There's an opportunity also referenced. Robbie, unpack that for me.
So, you know, the funny thing is, as I mentioned earlier, I saw Sarah just earlier this week for brunch. She was so gracious to come up or down. Which way would it be?
Down to you.
Down to have brunch. And I talked about this specific thing because in that letter, Tony says, he says, you know, to Lisa, I had nothing to do with this. And then he says, and I, you know, basically, I don't know if your father had anything to do with this, right? That kind of struck me because if Tony had actually moved the car at Ken's request, I feel like he wouldn't have said that. Mm-hmm. Am I wrong? What do you guys think?
I actually had a different read on it. So you and I talked about that on Monday, and then I actually listened to that episode in the car on the drive home, and because I hadn't gotten there yet. I was binging. And I got a slightly different read on it than what I understood your read on it when we were talking over frittatas. So it actually rang to me that he did move the car. And that when he said, like, the way the phrasing was with, I don't know if your dad had anything to do with this or not, was more a secondary thought and kind of like, that's not the point of the conversation I'm trying to have with you, as opposed to, gee, I've been really pondering this. And the last thing, you know, on the opportunity, the way it was sort of thrown in also, like with the phrasing, struck me as much more of a just like, look, I was in trouble with some other stupid stuff with that fight from before, you know, whatever. And this, they were kind of like going to supposedly give me a deal to get out of it and, or to not be an accessory to murder, you know, after the fact for having moved the car and something like that. That's how it all sort of read to me. And honestly, that whole idea of like giving him a deal tracks with how we know Lammy was working Jason as well, offering up deals that, you know, quite frankly, he's not legally in a position to make to anybody, but that, you know, an 18 or 19 year old kid is not going to know that. And Tony would be in the same position, like, oh, he's offering me immunity on all this other stuff, as long as I help them with this. And I don't know if your dad had anything to do with it or not, but I can't, I, you know what I mean? Like, I have to, you know, tell them what I know, you know, blah, blah, blah. That was sort of my read on it.
Here's a little bit of information that kind of clicked for me after we had that conversation, because obviously I kept thinking about it afterwards. Number one, so in the time between Tony telling Lammy that he had moved the car, which was early 89, and the time he is arrested, which is late 89, in that like nearly year, he had spoken to a lot of different, he was in North Carolina, and a lot of different people reported back that Tony had told them that he was working with the police, he's cooperating with the police, he's a witness in a case. There was one person, and I didn't really think about this until our conversation, who actually said that Tony said he was going to get paid to be a witness. And then I remembered, oh, there was actually a reward offered in this case. Early on, before Lammy, I wondered
if a reward was going to enter into it at some point. I thought maybe the Raisins t-shirt guy was
going to be getting it.
Yeah.
He heard it through the grapevine.
He did. A reward was offered, and then it was like doubled. It was just a couple of grand. Mm-hmm. There's no information about whether it was actually awarded out or not, like that kind of, and that happens all the time. Like it kind of, we have no idea what really happened there. But that could have been the opportunity also that, you know, Lammy was dangling. If he actually did say to somebody that I'm going to get paid to be a witness, that could have been the opportunity he was referring to.
It absolutely could have. Or even to, there are times when informants are paid and it's considered okay. Like, it's, you know what I mean? So,
Yeah. I mean, the fact that he says, I think in the same letter that, you know, I wasn't trying to set your father up for myself. I was doing it for the police. It's hard to understand what Tony is saying, right? Like, also, the language is, just, I mean, obviously, he wasn't very detailed there. It just raises, this is what happens when, like, investigators pull stuff with one person. You don't know what they've pulled with other people, right? It's hard to, like, give credibility to any of it, right? This is the problem. I mean, so if they were able to get Tony and Jason to say and do all this other stuff, you know, they easily could have done this with Tony earlier on the car thing, because they knew the car was a problem. They had to, like, they have to make these pieces fit, and they're trying to get Ken. So because it's hard to give credibility to almost anything at this point, it's like, maybe he moved the car, maybe he didn't. Maybe Lammy made him say it. Like, I just feel like anything's possible now.
Anything's possible. And that was real, obviously, what the defense attorney, what Sisti was saying is, you know, to arguing to the judge and then, you know, I guess able to say to the jury, look, we can't trust anything that he says because he violated this, you know, this gag order, and therefore everything is out the window. And that, you know, it sort of becomes fruit of the poisonous tree.
Yeah.
My take on the Tony letter and is just I not having read it a couple of times and knowing all the content, that it didn't seem like he was using that platform to overly declare his innocence. He wasn't going over and over again. It seemed more like less trying to convince Lisa that he's innocent and more expressing his concern for thinking her concern is about Ken and, you know, I'm setting up Ken or whatever. I thought, you know, and this is if he's being 100% sincere and he's not trying to manipulate somebody's perspective. But as a listener, I kind of took that away. Boy, he wasn't using this to, like, you know, beg for forgiveness or to overly perform a, you know, it's not me, it's not me, it's not me. It just seemed more like his thoughts were elsewhere. He's writing about, you know, I hope the kid, our son is okay, and, you know, stuff like that.
It seemed to me like he wanted her. It seemed to me like the most important part of the letter was the part where he says, I don't want you to think that I have not been trying to contact you all this time. I was told I was not allowed to. And, like, he's much more concerned. And we've seen that behavior from Tony in the past where he is sort of like, obviously they have a tumultuous relationship, but where he sort of keeps trying to reconcile or sort of keeps trying to get back in her life. And this just struck me as one more of those, like, can we just set this whole thing aside because I still want to be in your life?
Yeah. And he wants pictures of his son and stuff.
Right.
I want to talk about the relationship between Sergeant Lammy and defense attorney Mark Sisti in a minute. But before we even get there, Lammy has maybe you could call it interference. He's certainly trying to pull some strings as far as who is going to represent Jason. And he's certainly trying to swing everybody away from Mark Sisti for reasons we'll get to. Robbie, do you find that? I mean, of course, everything. Let me answer my own question. You find that very odd that an investigator would try to get involved in the defense of anybody.
I think it's highly unethical. This was the point at which I was like, I think in many ways, Sergeant Lammy was acting as he was trained to do. He was this pit bull. He was getting his confession one way or the other. He was, you know, towing all kinds of lines. This is, I think, when he really crossed a line, which is to try to manipulate who would be representing Jason, but beyond that, but also saying, I need to know everything, all the communications. Like, we need to control his attorneys. He used that language over and over, according to both the Carrolls, that we have to try to control his attorneys. That is terrible.
It's stunning. I can't, it blew my mind And especially knowing that he was actively pursuing the death penalty on the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah. And trying to talk him out of getting probably the most preeminent defense attorney that the state has to offer, to try to wave him off of that guy and get, you know, nothing against public defenders, but trying to get him to take what could be perceived as a lesser quality attorney.
Mm-hmm. I just can't. So, you know, one of the things I want to make clear is, you know, when he's telling Karen, Jason's mother, to ask Jason what was said between him and his attorney, we have to remember all those communications between the attorney and the client are privileged. The privilege exists as long as that client or the attorney doesn't tell anybody else, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That privilege is broken. So you can make the technical argument that, well, by the time it got to Lammy, it was broken anyways, but it was broken because of Lammy. You understand what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
At Lammy's behest, Karen is asking Jason, tell me what your lawyer said. And Jason is complying because he's a kid who has no idea like what he's actually doing and the legal ramifications of it. And also the real world ramifications as Sergeant Lammy is trying to, he's just desperate. He knows that what's coming is that he's going to be slammed on the confession. The confession's going to be attacked. What he really wants is for Jason to just like take a deal and mm-hmm. have this not go to trial. One of the interesting things that Jason's attorney said to me when we spoke a little while ago, she said, you know, when somebody confesses and then they still go to trial, that is them saying, I don't stand by that confession. Like, you know, that confession was not a true confession, because that if you're going to trial, it means you're challenging what you confess to. Otherwise, you can confess and just take your deal and move on.
Right. I'm going to insert Kevin Flynn one last time in this episode.
As many times as you want, Kevin. We love it.
It's actually relevant. I'm going to be reading from page 141 of my book, Our Little Secret, which involves Sergeant Lammy. He gets involved in a murder case that has been cold for about 4 or 5 years. He's just received a letter pointing to a teenage friend of the daughter of the victim. So he is interviewing the brother of that now suspect and the father of the suspect and the father of the brother that Lammy and his partner is questioning, pulled up in front of the house. John Windhurst Sr. stumbled out of the car and slammed the door. He pointed a finger at the large, bald-headed cop leaning on the front post. You, he said to Lammy, I know about you. You know what my lawyer said about you? Know what? Lammy asked curiously. That you're an asshole, that you're a scumbag. Windhurst kept swearing at the cop, shaking his fists. He says you are a treacherous cop and can't be trusted. Windhurst continues, he said not to talk to the cops and especially not Lammy. Windhurst kind of apologizes later. He cools off. He says, I'm sorry, I lost my composure. I wasn't expecting to see you here. I apologize, Sergeant Lammy. That's all right, Mr. Windhurst, but it is true what my lawyer said to me. That I'm an asshole scumbag? That I shouldn't talk to the police? He said, who is representing your son? Mark Sisti.
Damn.
So, yeah, Lammy and Sisti go back a long ways. This is obviously after the Carroll case. It's funny because we do get to hear from Sisti, who ends up representing Tony, not Carroll. And again, sort of the weird contradiction of this case is even Sisti says, A, Lammy is a great detective with good instincts. B, we love having a case with him because we know he did something wrong.
Yeah. I mean, he calls him a genius. It's hard. I don't know what to. Sarah, have you ever worked with a detective like this? Anybody like this? I feel like, is this a common like archetype?
It is a common archetype. I think, obviously, and hopefully there are, it's sort of a dying breed because stuff is getting thrown out more and more. And, you know, I caught that too. And one of the things that I kind of yelled at the car radio when I was driving back from brunch is that, I mean, he may be really good at thinking outside of the box and coming up with some stuff. I mean, I told you, I kind of love the idea of like, this person won't come out and talk to me, so I'm going to pull the fire alarm. There's nothing illegal. I mean, I guess right, it's a misdemeanor, yeah. You know what I mean? But it's like, he does seem to have a way of thinking outside the box, but one, he relies entirely too much on that. Because at the end of the day, this isn't a TV show. And you know, it matters that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. Two, and this is the sort of the larger point, the deck is stacked against, I mean, I know that the constitutional protections are specifically outlined, and the episode did a great job of sort of going into this, of like covering why the Constitution and why, you know, the Bill of Rights spend so much time talking about accused persons and like allowing for people to be protected. And so sometimes I think cops and investigators feel like the deck is stacked against us when, you know what I mean? That like, well, they've got all these extra protections and we have to kind of like wedge our way in. But the fact is, when it comes to resources, when it comes to time, when it, you know, the deck is really very much stacked against a suspect. And that's why those protections exist. And because of the way the deck is stacked and because of the way that our laws are written and even the way the Constitution is written, in my mind, if you are that good at thinking outside the box, you should be able to think outside the box and still work within the rules. Mm. In order to gain real probable cause, like genuine court upheld probable cause, you can do it following the rules and still almost always be able to do it. In my mind, everything from a simple traffic stop to a homicide investigation, you can always play within the rules. And if this person really broke the law, you can get them.
Right.
Right.
And sometimes it does require thinking outside the box, but thinking outside the box doesn't mean thinking outside the rules. And that's to me where if you're that much of a genius, you should be able to do this and have all of your confessions upheld, because they should be good confessions because you actually caught the person who did it.
Right.
That's my thinking.
Yeah. And you know, the truth is, I can't imagine if I'm a prosecutor, I would not want to be prosecuting Lammy's cases. Like he would be a nightmare. You know, I mean, Sisti might be dancing when they got his cases, but as a prosecutor, I'd be like, Jesus, like he would just make like their lives so much harder. Like it would.
Well, he kind of ruined the case against Tony. I mean, I'm sure the prosecutors believed that he was involved at that point, and Lammy sank the case against Tony essentially by talking to his partner.
Well, there was that, but also the fact that, you know, I mean, when they interviewed the jury afterward, did they buy the confession at all? The confession sucked. You know, you've got crappy confessions. You've got witnesses who are like, or co-defendants who are like, we are not testifying against each other. What do you got? So, and all of that is because of how the case was investigated and how the charges came to be.
Yep.
So was the issue with Lammy breaking the sequestration where he talked to his partner after his testimony and before Scott's, that is the problem that he just did that? Or is the problem because he said something that would affect Scott's testimony because he's got to shore up something or whatever. What was the big issue there?
Look, at the end of the day, and I don't have the text of the sequestration order, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of pleadings and motions and all kinds of things that I don't have. But if it's like most sequestration orders, it just means it doesn't matter. No contact, zero contact. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. It could be a much more narrower sequestration order in which it says you can have contact, but you can't talk about XYZ things. The problem is it kind of doesn't matter. Not only did they have contact, they talked about the case. They talked about his testimony. He said to prepare. Now, On the stand, Lammy said, well, yeah, I mean, I just told him that this is what I testified about. And I said, you'll be probably testifying about the same thing. So make sure you review the statements, this and that. But even that was beyond any sequestration order. So, you know,
it's the police version of getting your story straight that they would be just as likely to, you know what I mean? Like there's a reason you separate co-defendants mm-hmm. the second you've, you know, I mean, if you're arresting them, you separate them so that they can't get their story straight. It's the same thing. It's just trying to put some integrity into the process for the jury.
Yeah, one might say, oh, well, it was an innocent communication, but it was certainly bad enough that Scott felt that he needed to, you know, tell this to the court, that, you know, he couldn't just, it wasn't like, oh, yeah, it went well. Whatever the content was, it was bad enough that he felt a duty to report that, even if it meant having I don't know, was a day and a half or what, a huge chunk of Lammy's, all of Lammy's testimony getting tossed and damaging a homicide case. Okay, so I don't know, have either of you ever watched Game of Thrones?
Oh, God, I love it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So you, so for those who haven't, you may, or those who have, you may recall that a couple of seasons in, there was an episode where an event had happened called the Red Wedding. Mm-hmm. And it's where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a bunch of the main characters get killed in a double cross at a wedding. And for those of us who only watched the TV show and never read the books, it was absolutely shocking.
Shocking.
We were flabbergasted. We went on social media like we couldn't believe it. And all of the people that I knew who read the books were so snotty because they knew it was coming.
Yeah. You know, it was my husband, actually, when we watched it, he had read the books and he had already watched the show through once. Like, he sort of like made me watch the show. And when the Red Wedding happened, and I was obviously had the reaction that everybody else had, at one point I turned and I looked at him and he was only watching me, but like,
yes!
eating pop, because his whole thing was like, I am just here to watch your reaction to this.
I had two friends who missed that and said, oh, I taped it. Come on over. And I videotaped their reaction. This is how
I lost my mind. I lost my mind when that happened. Yeah.
This is how I felt when you announced that Ken walked from court, that they dropped the charges. Because, you know, Sarah, you might have been screaming at the radio for something else. I got to imagine everybody else was screaming when they heard that. Can somebody please walk me through the rationale why the state might drop the charges against Ken Johnson?
You want to have a shot at it, Sarah? I was going
to
say.
Well, I mean, you're the lawyer here, so I'll definitely end up deferring ultimately to you. But, it seemed like the case was kind of a mess because they had chosen this tactic of going after the conspiracy angle and the co-defendant angle. I mean, it's even sounded like listening to, you know, that episode that everybody sort of felt if they had just gone after Ken, they had a pretty solid case. But because they didn't, because they chose this tactic of the conspiracy, it wasn't a strong enough case against him, and they wanted to be able to have a second bite at the apple. And they knew that if he was acquitted, I mean, obviously I know you covered that in it, but that is really salient, and it's really important that you don't want to miss that strike. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you hit me, you better land the punch. And that's very real.
According to reports in the media, you know, this came as a shock to everybody, obviously, like, and especially in the public. You know, they had to decide, are we going to go forward and prosecute Ken based on, you know, we have no witnesses who are going to testify against him. We don't think we're going to be able to introduce the actual confessions, any of them. They did their own internal legal analysis and believed that they would not find a way to introduce those, the confessions, probably because of, I mean, it's just all technical stuff. Like, you know, in what cases you can introduce stuff, you know, confessions like that, and when you cannot. And they decided that there just would be no legal way to do it. So you don't have the confessions. You don't have the people confessing. What do you have, right? You can say that they might have been able to make a very strong circumstantial case against Ken, but imagine a case against Ken that has no mention of Jason and Tony. It would have been hard. And Jason and Tony both were like, we are going to trial. We are not making any deal. Like, there was no deal happening here that they could then come back. And so they just decided, we, exactly what Sarah said, that we know we're going to swing and miss. We'd rather wait until we maybe have a better case down the line. Maybe something will change during the course of Jason and Tony's trials, or maybe we'll find some new evidence or something. And they just had to let it go. I don't think they let it go thinking, we're going to let this go forever. But that's what happened. Yeah. Ken was
it
never.
It seems to me that, yeah, that happens more often than not, even when prosecutors say, I mean,
we'll come back.
Right. The you know, obviously the really famous case of Martha Moxley in Connecticut and the Kennedy family member who was accused of killing her. And it kind of kept going round and round, and he would get released and it would be overturned or whatever. And in the end, they were supposed to uphold the original conviction, and he had been out on bail because one of the convictions had been overturned on, you know, on appeal and stuff. And after like 3 years or something of them, of the prosecution saying over and over, we're going to go back in and make him go back to prison, they just said, never mind, we're dropping it. And it happens. They just new cases come in and they can't do the workload, and it just,
and the further you are out from a crime, I mean, like, you know, you've got witnesses dying, you're losing evidence over time.
Yep.
Yeah. Levert asked on Twitter, and I think maybe you've answered the question about the dropping of the charges. He asked, you know, was it because they didn't have enough evidence about the solicitation, or because they didn't have enough evidence at all to implicate him in the death? And it just seems like they didn't have, you know, what they had, what they could use was not enough. And the wisest thing was to, let's put it in the
without
drawer.
Without Tony and Jason, they had nothing, period.
What I have never been able to wrap my head around is, if it's a conspiracy, if it's a murder for hire, if you don't have the hirer, how do you continue to pursue the case against the hirees? Like, that's the part that to me blew my mind, that they saw one side. They saw the whole thing about like, well, we can't convict him without them. But how did you think you were going to convict them? I mean, obviously they got one of them, but, you know.
Yeah. And it was the murder for hire aspect that made it a capital offense
right. In
New Hampshire. That's an important element. Absolutely.
Well, and that would be the only reason in the world that Jason would be involved, because he'd never laid eyes on either of these people. So, I mean, if theoretically Jason had done this, there's the only reason to do it is for hire. And if you're not pursuing the guy who hired him, it boggles the mind.
Carrie asked on Twitter, I don't know if I missed it, but was there any significant outcome to Jason's mother contacting Sharon's brother? I understand it was a measure of her attempts to save Jason, but did anything else come out of that connection, Rabia?
No, you know, Ken Eaton, as soon as he hung up, basically called the police and reported it. And that's why we know this happened. He called them and said that this is what she did. And he was not comfortable with it. He reported what she said. And he said, you know, if she contacts me again, I don't want to talk to her. I feel like this could hurt the case somehow against Jason. And I don't think she actually even tried after that. I think she heard, she was just desperate. I think she heard some measure of sympathy from Sharon's family in a TV interview. And maybe she thought, if I can just convince them, maybe they can make, this is before the court had ruled that the death penalty couldn't be applied in this case. So she was thinking, maybe this is one way. If the family says that we don't want to pursue a death penalty against Jason, maybe that could help.
Danny asks, and he starts with an, is it just me? Or does the state trying to meddle with who Jason Carroll secured as the defense attorney seem a lot like the state playing games with Jay's defense in Adnan's case? Is there an echo?
Oh, yeah, it's very much like that. The difference here being that you've got a detective doing it versus a prosecutor doing it, which is what happened in Adnan's case. In Adnan's case, you know, Kevin Urich, the prosecutor, completely was in charge of Jay's defense, basically, you know, got the lawyer for him, set it all up, made sure it was pro bono, all these things. I mean, so, but I think it was more egregious in Jason's case, to be honest.
Yeah. We had a whole bunch of other social media posts that I wanted to get to, but we were kind of running a little long. I'll just summarize this one from Tiffany. This case pisses me off. And everybody agrees with you, Tiffany.
Yeah. Co-signed, yeah.
Co-signed, yes. 10 out of 10 would agree. So, Rabia, give us a little preview about what we're going to hear in episode 9.
Yeah, so now we're at the point where Jason stands alone. And we get to hear why Jason was convicted, how he was convicted, what got him convicted. And also, we're going to take a look at, I mean, this is like such an important, I mean, if we can all agree that Jason didn't do it, then the question is who did it? And so I think I'm going to try to squeeze in a section into the next week's episode. Yeah, people, this is all happening in real time, by the way, into next week's episode as to like, what are the facts actually tell us? What do we know for sure? And in what ways does that contradict any possibility that Jason or Tony were involved? But mostly, you know, we got to circle back to the crime and what happened to Sharon.
And are we going to hear any more Thelma and Louise type travel log between you and Sarah at the end of the episode?
There's always more to share there. I think I haven't decided. I usually get to the end of an episode and decide, what's the clip I want to put in here? So yeah, you're going to hear it. You're going to hear it. But I don't know. Like this past week, I think it wasn't to Sarah and I. It was us talking to Debbie. And that's the clip I decided to use. But we'll see how I feel at the end of this one next week.
We have to use the clip where you guys pick up Brad Pitt hitchhiking.
I look, this was one of the best road trips. Actually, both of these trips that we did, we just had so much fun in spite of it being such a serious and hard endeavor. And so
we also, we didn't have Brad Pitt, but we had a different hostage in the backseat. And we'll talk about him later. We're not going to divulge that quite yet. We'll divulge that in the finale.
Aha. Okay, excellent. Well, Sarah, Caitlin, thank you so much for not only coming on the addendum, but for all the work that you've done on season 6 with Rabia. It's
thank
a great
you.
Case, and it's better because of your contributions.
I really appreciate that. That means a lot. Thank you.
And Rabia, thank you again for coming on the show and telling us all about this fascinating case.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Now, if you, dear listener, have questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can ask them on social media. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Thanks so much to executive producer Mithil Telhan and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for continuing to let me be a part of their work. For everyone at Undisclosed, even the California Raisins, thank you so much for listening. More to come next week.